It's time to catch the beat from Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign. And Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Featuring three floors of gently used books, greeting cards, journals, and more. Jane Addams Bookshop is at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign, online at janeaddams, that's A-D-D-A-M-S, books.com. As always on WEF, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Faye Jones, the Director of the Jenner Law Library at the University of Illinois and Clinical Professor of Law, teaching privacy law and AI, among other things. I heard you speak at the No Kings rally in October, and you have a particularly valuable perspective with 21 years of active and reserve service in the military as a judge advocate general in the Navy, known as a JAG officer, and you earned the Navy Achievement Medal for leadership as commanding officer and retired with the rank of commander, which is rather impressive. And you did that after law school. You came to the rally with particular concerns to share about what the Trump administration has done with a strategy of purge, surge, and merge relating to the military, firing the top military commanders, the superintendents of the military academies, and firing the top lawyers. Let's get the conversation going. Tell us what you see about this strategy and the concerns that brought you to speak at the No Kings rally.
There's a magazine called Task and Purpose, which is for military members. And in October of 25, they featured a story called Most Americans Say the Military Should Be Apolitical and Face Only External Threats. And the Trump administration bringing the National Guard into collaboration with ICE in various cities in the United States strikes me as completely a misuse of the military, including the National Guard. And I think that's a dangerous thing. I think he would like very much to politicize the military and have them, instead of having sworn on oath to protect and support the Constitution, to support and protect him, to make himself primary over the rule of law in this country. And that's why I wanted to speak at No Kings, because I'm very opposed to that idea.
And since October and the things that we have seen since then, what is your view on the ongoing issues?
I don't think the Trump administration is going to stop in their attempt to destroy democracy in this country and to impose their authoritarian regime. I think Trump has no plans to pay attention to the midterms, for example, or to accept that Americans really want democracy. I think he sees this as a business opportunity. Being the president is a business opportunity for him and his allies. I spoke at the No Kings rally about Oscar Benavides, who was a corrupt Peruvian president, who said, "For my friends, everything; for my enemies, the law." And I think that Trump will be trying to use his version of the law, as he's already shown he's going to do with a corrupt DOJ, Department of Justice, to try to intimidate and quiet voices in opposition to him. And he'll also try to co-opt the courts and make all of them, you know, take away the power of federal judges, impose upon them his desires, in which case we have really no democracy and no rule of law in this country. And I think we all have to resist that.
How did your experience in the military impact your career teaching law? And did you ever practice law?
I did practice law in the military. I was first in legal assistance, helping people with powers of attorney and wills and landlord-tenant problems. When I was stationed in Hawaii, a ship directed a submarine aircraft surveillance surveillance aircraft into a mountain on Maui, and all the crew were killed. And I had to see survivors of those military members about helping them get their estate settled and other kinds of things. So I started doing that first. I got put into prosecution as a trial counsel, and I stayed most of the time. I was at Hawaii and as a trial counsel. I did some federal tort claims, and then I went to be the lawyer at boot camp in San Diego, where I did a lot of administrative law.
When you left, how did you decide to go into academia, and what was your plan for the rest of your career?
I'd been a law librarian before I went to law school, and I went to law school to get the degree so that I could be a law library director. So I knew the path that I was going to be on. And when I left active duty, I was thinking, I don't like to crunch numbers. I don't want to do tax. Family law is terribly sad. Criminal law, your witnesses and the other side's witnesses lie to you. I just sort of eliminated a lot of things about the law. If privacy law and AI and the law had existed at the time, I probably would be practicing law. But I decided to come back to try to be a library director. I got to be a library director. And then I started saying, well, I need to prove my bona fides to the faculty and show that I can teach. And so I taught cyber law, which was a big survey about internet law. And then privacy became really important. And so I focused on privacy. And then AI came up. And that became something I also picked up because I'm the kind of person who sees a problem and tries to resolve it. And there just wasn't anyone else who was going to be teaching privacy and AI and the law. And so I said, I can do that.
Privacy is a very particular issue now. How do you teach your students in view of the threats to privacy with all of the internet and everything else?
That is a particular challenge, and there's a huge body of law about privacy at the federal and state level, as well as internationally, the GDPR, for example, in the EU and across the world. More and more privacy statutes are being passed. So, the challenge for privacy law is really to provide a survey of the area and to go into depth in some ways. But just more of sort of survey over the top and others. So the newest issues are about age verification for protection of children and the ability for not only the government but corporations to surveil people at all times. And our choices as individuals, where many of us have given up privacy for convenience. When you see one of those privacy policies, you just check, I agree. You don't read it to really find out what it's about. Increasingly, my class is about being sophisticated lawyers with dealing with this, and both from a perspective of representing a corporation and then from the other side, representing the individual, and thinking about our own individual privacy as well.
And how about AI in the law?
AI has become the hottest issue. And there's tremendous investment in it. And there's the thought that there may be a bubble and that AI may just, get into this billions of dollars and then collapse because there's so many different versions of generative AI, like ChatGPT and Claude and all those kinds of things. The problem with all of them is, except Claude, with one caveat, they've been taught to bluff like a poker player bluffs. And so they'll hallucinate things that are not there. So if you ask them what your birthday is, you might get three different answers. And only Claude is one of it's the only one so far that will say, I don't know. And that will give you an answer that is, you have to look further. You have to verify this in some other place. The other problem with ChatGPT is that, and Gen AI, is that it is trained to be agreeable. And so there have been some teen suicides where chat programs have helped teenagers plan a suicide. There's some vulnerabilities that we're finding out when we think of it as the latest, greatest. So this is AI, everything is wonderful with AI. That's not necessarily so. We're finding out more and more that it has its own particular problems.
What do you see in the students who are coming to the law school now, the students in your classes? What are they looking for?
It's very inspiring, actually. They really believe in the rule of law. They want to be the best kind of lawyers they can. You know, it used to be, I think, that a lot of students wanted to go into corporate law and make a lot of money. I now see students who genuinely believe in doing good and helping human flourishing, and that gives me hope.
Do you have specific advice for your students about the threats to the practice of, well, not the practice of law, carrying out law and legal decisions not being honored?
I have to try to be non-political in class because certainly there's a wide range of students, you know, from very liberal to very conservative. So what I try to do in class really is have the students read materials that we then discuss, and we read case interpretations and law review articles, philosophical texts, those kinds of things, to say, no matter what your perspective is, could there be another point of view that is equally valid as your own? So I'm trying to get them to realize that lawyers, good lawyers, look at both sides of an issue and try to genuinely understand the strategy of the other side as well, you know, both in transactional law, writing contracts and that sort of thing, and in litigation. Lawyers need to think ahead. Essentially, everything in the law is a negotiation, just like much of everyday life is a negotiation. And so that's the biggest skill I think that lawyers really need is communication, ability to negotiate, and willingness to do so.
At the rally, you talked about the importance of living with four cardinal virtues, and what you were just talking about reminds me of these. And the ones you named are courage, self-restraint, justice, and wisdom. I would think they all are very directly related to being a lawyer and having responsibility in being a lawyer in society. Where did you come up with these virtues as something that you really think we need to live by?
I didn't come up with them. They came from the Stoics. Epictetus, who was one of the first teachers of Stoicism, and Marcus Aurelius and his Meditations. And I've been a Stoic for probably 20 years, where trying to really embody those qualities. And I do think they're very particularly helpful for lawyers because sometimes we want to win so badly that we fail to be as morally courageous as we should be. And we really cannot promote rule of law if we're not genuinely fair and trying to reach the best outcome. You can be aggressive, an aggressive lawyer, but still be morally correct and you know, fair, I think, although sometimes it's tough, but even so, I do believe we can do that. And I think that those things build on each other. Courage, self-restraint, moderation, and then building towards justice and wisdom. I think we get better and better if we can embody those four qualities. And that's not just for lawyers.
And what do you see now that it's December after the No Kings rally in October, and there really hasn't been a national gathering on that scale since then? What do you see as the way we should be looking to register our beliefs and our voice and our protest?
I think we should be getting out and doing grassroots, getting people registered to vote, speaking up whenever there's an issue about there being an attempt to cut down on civil rights, because all of us are subject to losing our civil rights, I think, if we don't protest. And so I am heartened by the recent election of a Democrat for the first time in 20 years as the mayor of Miami, and by I think it's a state legislative seat in Georgia that was gerrymandered to be politically Republican, but a Democrat won nevertheless. I think people are starting to wake up and say, this is not government as usual. You know, a lot of people have the tendency to say, oh, all politicians, they're the same. This is not status quo as things have always been. This is definitely a very dangerous situation, And it is really time for us to all recognize that. And I think there will be more no kings protests, but I think we also have to have our individual everyday protests as well. Speaking out in local government, speaking out in the newspaper, talking to friends, being in community with other people about the fact that we want democracy to continue.
Before we started our interview, you mentioned that you're aware of programs to train more citizen activists. What would encompass being an activist in the kind of expression that we need now?
I think it would be writing to the newspaper, speaking up in your community, going to local political events, and being just being a citizen. A lot of people have been disengaged from participation, accepting that, just expecting that everything is going to be as it always has been, that they're going to be, everything's going to be normal. We are no longer in a normal state.
Going to ask you about the law library. Is there
Yeah, the
anything?
law library is just kind of the laboratory of the law. Students come there, and it's also a place where there's a lot of change. We are largely a digital library. It has changed tremendously since I started. Where it was mostly a paper clerical type job. Now it's really an everyday getting information out to people, pushing it to them digitally.
And what, as the director of the law library, what are your responsibilities and your goals?
I manage a staff of about 17, and I have a budget of about $2 million. And the goal is really to support our faculty and students' learning, teaching, learning, scholarship, public engagement. And so it's not just a place where students come and study, it's also a place where students collaborate on exams and writing outlines. I think of it as the heart of the law school because a lot of students come and read before class. One of them in particular is an Army colonel who's on terminal leave from his active service. He has a family and can't study at home. And I think there are significant students who have that. They need a third place, which the library is, for them to come to.
What do you see with student use at the law library?
It is true that students can use a lot of digital information from their own apartment or some other location. They're always on their phones with their laptops. They use a lot of things on their phone that I would never use that way, but that's, something we have to adapt to. But I think of the library as being the repository of the information. And unfortunately, because of the Trump administration, government information is no longer as reliable and trustworthy as it once was. And a lot of it, like jobs reports and statistics, have been shut down because the Trump administration doesn't want people to know how bad the economy actually is. And so that it seems to me like there's a need for universities and other kinds of think tanks, organizations to try to reproduce some of that information. But with the Trump administration's attack on universities, a lot of the research funding has been cut. It makes it very difficult. I think we're in a very tough spot right now.
Let's talk a bit about your experience in the military. And your father was a World War II veteran and Korea. And I think was a big factor in your going into the military. What do you think of young people going into the military now and how it is as a career compared to when you were in the military?
Well, certainly for people going in now, it's much more technical than it was. The Army just bought a huge group of drones, which they want to use on the battlefield and in other kinds of operations to not have people out there in harm's way. But those require a whole set of agreements about how that will be used, who will be the operators, who has liability if something goes wrong. The laws of war international and international law are something that we really need to have. And with the Trump administration's lawlessness, I really think they're missing the point altogether. If we want our soldiers and sailors and airmen to be protected, we need to observe the Geneva Convention and other kinds of laws and international laws. So far, the professionalism and meritocracy of the military has been protected, but I think there is an attempt to change that, and that's devastating, I believe. For new people going into the military, there is an opportunity to get a lot of education. Unfortunately, under the current Secretary of War, there is an attempt to chase out women, black people, and I don't know how that's actually going to work, frankly, because the Army is largely black and Hispanic, and there are tremendous numbers of variety and diversity of people, in the military across the board. In the Navy, there's a substantial amount of Filipino people. I know a woman who is trans who was a gunner's mate. And there are opportunities there in the military that you're not going to find in civilian life to really make contributions and to build a career. I hope the military isn't damaged because I think their goal really should be protecting our national security, not being used in adventures and jingoistic behavior like blowing fishermen out of the water in the Caribbean. You are taught not to obey an illegal order, but that puts the individual service member on the hook. If I say, I won't do that, that's an illegal order, then I will get court-martialed and have to defend myself and prove that it is an illegal order. So that's a, difficult choice, I think, for junior enlisted in particular, junior officers. I would hope that at senior levels, there would be more people like Admiral Halsey who resigned because he would not comply with the Trump administration's illegal orders. There is someone who will do it. That's unfortunate. Well, if there's ever real Nuremberg-type trials for these things that are happening, off of Venezuela and in the Caribbean, there are going to be some people who are brought to task who probably never have thought of themselves as being a criminal.
What about the interaction between the American legal system and international?
We do have a lot of interaction, and not just in a military sense either. In Europe, they have the greater protection for privacy, and they've often declared that American corporations have inadequate protection of privacy. And so we've had various agreements with Europe where we've tried to say, okay, we can protect privacy in this way. Does that meet your standards? And there have been a number of cases by an activist called Max Schrems. And I think that under the current administration, there's likely to be a third Schrems case challenging what corporations in the US can do in terms of data transfers about employees, airline tickets, other kinds of commercial transactions that don't meet European standards. And then China also has its own privacy laws. And so corporations, US corporations who are doing business or have employees in China have to comply with those too. So it becomes extremely complex across the world for business to meet all of the compliance standards. And then AI puts another, difficult layer on that too. And so that's why I think that this is full employment, the Full Employment for Lawyers Act. There'll be lots of lawyers needed for this kind of, meeting requirements internationally, as well as here in the United States. The Trump administration is going to try to have an executive order that says that states can't regulate artificial intelligence, but that's not how this is supposed to work. Congress, if they want to preempt state action, can pass a statute that does that, and then the president signs it. Just the president issuing an executive order should not be enough to say to states like California and Illinois, you can't regulate AI. I'm reading a book right now called Giving Up is Unforgivable by Joyce Vance. It's a manual for keeping democracy, and it's a short book and easy to read. But the chapter that she calls We Are the Calvary is one that I'd like to have everybody read. And it's where I got some of my ideas about what we can do as individuals to have rules for the cavalry so that we can respond when the Trump administration and, frankly, the tech bros try to impose authoritarianism instead of democracy in this country. And so the first rule that she talks about is being smart, not engaging in arguments with people on the other side. When we look at some of the MAGA sites on X, for example, a lot of them are fake sites. And so if you spend your time arguing with people on the internet, you're quite often going to be spinning your wheels and wasting your energy talking with a bot from Pakistan or from Russia or, from other places in the world. They're not even legitimate Americans. Then being in community and never worrying alone, talking to other people, having this interview, just as you're doing and preserving discussions about this. And she says, never bet against America. Instead of doom and gloom and saying, oh, it's all just falling apart. This is the craziest thing we've ever lived through. Think about what you can do that's positive. And for me, that comes back to those four Stoic virtues about keeping ourselves centered and trying to accomplish some good in the moment. Whatever, we define that good as, we have to keep doing it. Things can't go on the way they are. I don't think we can keep going like this. Something that we've never really dealt with in this country is that there is a real basic racism that we have refused to confront. And if we can get through this Trump thing, I really hope that we can have a national reconciliation where we talk about how our ancestors and the government treated Native Americans and Black people and other kinds of minority people. Pre-Trump, I thought we needed a new civil rights movement. I didn't envision me being involved in that. I thought it was going to be minority people leading that and saying, you're still not treating us fairly. Now I think we're it. We are the cavalry. No one's going to come and save us. We have to save ourselves.
I am very grateful, Faye, that you are in the role you are in education, in the law, because I think you are helping to train the generation for things that will be evolving that I have no idea what they will be and how to solve them.
Students often want to know what you think, and they want you to be honest about it. And I won't usually do it in class, but I will outside of class if students want to know. If I can encourage them to be more democratic, more engaged American citizens, that's what I think is my purpose as well.
Thank you very much for this time, Faye, at the
Well,
end
it's been fun
of the
talking with
semester.
you.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. I give a big thanks to Dr. Faye Jones, professor of law at the University of Illinois and director of the Jenner Law Library. She spoke at the October No Kings rally and offers a valuable perspective on the crisis this country is facing around challenges to law as a foundation to democracy. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Featuring three floors of gently used books, greeting cards, journals, and more. Jane Addams Bookshop at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Online at janeadamsbooks.com. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. You can also listen to live stream and archive shows on the WEFT app, available on your favorite app store. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod, see you next time.
You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, where you'll find music, news, and views that are nowhere else on the airwaves.
Support for WEFT Radio comes from Urbana Arts and Culture, providing resources such as arts grants, artist opportunities, events, and other arts and culture programming. Since 2008, the program fosters a city where all residents may engage with the arts and where artists thrive and are valued. The City of Urbana's Arts and Culture Program continues to